Time now to check in with our rural reporters. This week, the specially trained truffle hunting dogs helping farmers dig up the prized delicacies. We'll meet students taking part in a different type of school sport. They're practicing their bull riding skills as part of a rodeo club. And we'll head into the workshop with a craftsman giving hands-on lessons in making furniture, 18th century style. Plus, we'll check in with a couple of grey nomads making their way across the top of the country. Rather than travelling by a four-wheel drive or camper van, they're tackling the outback on a pushbike.
I didn't get to live in the 1700s when everything was pioneering, so this is my little attempt at doing something a little bit out there and challenging and see how I cope.
It's a bit of a, you know, a bit of a thrill when you're going along, and at the start of the day you think, oh gee, it's a long way to the next stop, but before you know it you've stopped and had a break and you're nearly there. And when you're on a road bike, most of the time it's about the destination. What we're doing, it's all about the journey.
Truly savouring the journey, and what a journey it is, more than 3,000 kilometres across some of the most remote parts of the country. That's coming up. But first, assembling something from a flat pack could very well be the limit of many Australians' knowledge of furniture making. But a woodwork instructor is finding huge interest from those wanting to learn how to make traditional style wooden chairs.
We source the wood locally. It's Robinia pseudo-acacia. It's not a native tree, it's an imported tree, but it splits really nicely and it's really, really nice furniture timber. It's nice to use.
In a rustic farm shed, Jeff Tonkin is keeping alive a more than 300-year-old tradition.
From there, we cut them up into lengths, and these logs here, you can see a chair leg length, about 510 millimetres. So we break them up using a splitting axe, and we break it up into segments, cutting it up like a cake. So it comes out, you get a section of cake, and then we break that down, and in each segment there's a leg for a chair.
Jeff is teaching green woodworking, using only hand tools to craft beautiful custom-made furniture. Hello, I'm Luke Wong. I'm here with Jeff on his farm at Cumminock in central west New South Wales, where he runs courses sharing his knowledge of traditional woodworking. Those who have come along to this course will learn to make a chair in the same way they were made in 18th century England. While the method and tools Jeff teaches date back hundreds of years, he only took a serious interest in woodwork after a career change.
Well, I was a wool grower for nearly 40 years, and then I sold the place and wondered what I was going to do. And I went off and did a full-time course in fine woodworking at Sturt School for Wood and just loved it. It was the best year of my life. So I've just grown from there, really. I lived in Sydney for 3 years and had a workshop in Sydney and a cooperative workshop and just did commission work, living by the seat of your pants, you know, trying to pay the rent. And I also did some instrument making in Sydney with Gelee guitars, and I worked for a harp maker at Gosford, and I just loved it all. But eventually never intended to stay in Sydney all that long. And so I've come back here and had the opportunity to set a workshop up here in 2010. The thing just grew exponentially to what it is today.
What type of people are interested in these courses?
Well, of the 8 people on this course, 7 of them have done the course before. One man has done it. This is his 8th course. The others, just looking around them there now, 2 or 3 of them have done it at least twice or 3 times, and there's another guy there who's done it 4 times. So chair making can become addictive, I think. And they're not making them because they want another chair in the house. I think they just enjoy the comradeship and the atmosphere, and they just come here and can forget all about their worries, and they just have a great 10 days, and we have a great lot of fun. We certainly enjoy having them, and some of them become old friends now.
Quite a traditional workshop in a sense that it's almost like travelling back in time. I'm seeing a lot of tools here that look like that they're from another era, and they're also hand-powered. Can you tell me about these?
Well, they are from another era. They're called pole lathes. They're driven by a pole. These ones have all got stringy bark poles. They're about 5 metres long, and they're hooked up in the shed, and a string comes down off the end of the pole and goes round the piece of wood that the person's turning and just down onto a treadle, which is just a swinging up and down on a hinge, swinging up and down stick, and they just push it up and down and the wood turns round and back and round and back and round and back, and each time they push it down, they can carve a bit off the piece of wood that spins.
These skills that you learned over years of practice, why do you want to teach them to other people?
Oh, I think they're great to keep all these skills alive. it's fantastic that these skills, which were on the point of complete extinction, I think probably 10 or 15 years ago, now these sorts of courses become so popular because people want to go back to a more basic, earthy requirement. And we've done that here. I built a blacksmith shop there at the back of the shed, and we cut up old saw blades and old springs and stuff. We've been making all the tools, made most of the tools for the lathes. So there's something really satisfying about taking something off the scrap heap, like an old saw blade, turning it into a lovely chisel, using it on the woodwork. It's very satisfying. it's not the chair at the end, it's the journey that people have in making their chair. And at the end of it, they almost inevitably say, oh, please put me down to next year's course.
My name's Gabriel Shannon, and I'm on my fourth chair-making course with Jeff Tonkin here in Cumnock.
What do you get out of doing woodwork when you can just purchase furniture down at the store and assemble it?
I think like several of the people here, I've been a professional throughout my life. I really haven't had time to do craft work. And there's something enormously rewarding about doing things with your hands and at the end of 10 days having a finished product, an object which is really useful and beautiful to look at. And that's what I think we all get out of this. The manual tasks and the effort that you put into creating and wood turning and joining and then ending up with a wonderful chair.
What's the importance of learning these skills, even though that you might not put them into a professional venture?
I think like any of the craft skills, it makes you appreciate what people have done before and not to take things for granted so much, I guess. The other thing is that these things are really made to last. And a lot of the furniture and other objects you see at the moment isn't really made to last. So I think it makes you appreciate the value of labour, of physical effort, and of taking the time and the trouble to try to make something beautiful with skills that you learn. And that's very different to what most of us are doing in our professional lives, or were doing in our professional lives.
What did you used to do in your professional life?
I was a medical practitioner.
So much different working with these tools and also in this type of workshop environment. So have you got any blisters to show for it?
We haven't got toughened hands. Our hands toughen up here. So lots of splinters and lots of cuts, but that's all part of the beauty of it.
After school on a Wednesday evening, these students are taking part in a bit of a different school sports program. They're members of their school's rodeo club and they're practicing bull riding skills.
Just fun. I got a passion for it. Love the adrenaline rush. Yeah, it's a good sport to be in.
I suppose when you make a ride, like you get like a fair bit of adrenaline rush going through you and feel pretty good after that.
These students attend St. Brendan's College at Yeppoon in central Queensland. For more than 20 years, the school has been supporting students in the sport of rodeo.
It's a bit of a mind game, you kind of sort of psych yourself out, get your head in the zone, and put your hand in that rope as quick as you can, get out, and just go with the flow and do what you think you need to do. One of the things that got me going, I've always wanted to do a bull ride during my life, but never really had the chance, and come to Brendan's and it was right there, so.
Hello, I'm Erin Semler. I've come to watch the students practice under the watchful eye of teacher and rodeo club coordinator, Bill Oram.
St. Brendan's is fairly famous for being a rugby league school and catering for all sports, but we try and also cater for alternate sports. I also am the coordinator for our cattle club, so we show lead steers at regional shows. We also promote the rodeo club as a real outlet, particularly for kids from the bush, because it's often their sport. And we actually find kids coming to St. Brendan's specifically because we have a rodeo club. We've got some cowboys that compete around the state, but we also allow them to practice at the Great Western. So we come up here every Wednesday night. Occasionally we get here on a Friday night, and we try and get all our cowboys to any of the Great Western rodeos, which are once a month, or some of the other local rodeos. I get a lot of pleasure out of taking these boys around to rodeos and watching them grow up to become good young men as well as good cowboys. The St. Brendan's Rodeo Club has actually been an integral part of rodeo in Queensland these days. I was at a rodeo recently and probably at least half the competitors were either current St Brendan's boys in our rodeo club or past rodeo club members, people that had come through the rodeo program at St Brendan's.
Tanya Bode's son Ben is one of the members of the St Brendan's College Rodeo Club.
Ben went to a rodeo out west at the end of last year at Dejara and got the bug. And so he was at Willow State High School and we decided we were going to send him away in grade 10. So looking at St Brendan's and his love of riding bulls and steers was sort of a bit of a inspiration, I guess, to send him there. So so he loves it. Mr Oram brings him up every Wednesday night and we try and get in and on a Friday or whenever there's a rodeo in town. So yeah, yes, just having that avenue, I guess, to come up here during the week and do that and pursue it. Ben wants to work outside, he wants to work on a property, so I guess it's a bit of an interest and a bit of a hobby at the moment that he can sort of, if he does pursue something in like a rural lifestyle, then he can sort of do it on a weekend when he's out working or whatever. So yeah.
She says she's not too concerned about the risks that come with the sport.
I sort of think they've got the protective gear on and that's sort of what gives me a little bit of peace of mind, I guess. And the radio protective guys, you sort of, I guess, put your faith in them. At the moment, just starting out, like they're not on really bad bulls or rank bulls, I guess. So that's a little bit easier to watch as well. So maybe as they get older and start riding bigger bulls, I'll be like, a bit more worried, but yeah.
Many of the members of the school's rodeo club are boarders, like Year 11 student Philip Sheehan.
The mateship you get from it, even though it's just you on the bull, it's like you got a whole team, got your mates are helping you on. But being a boarder, you obviously have time to study and you have time to do sort of things like that. So you just fit it in your free time, I guess. Do a bit after school every day if you can. Do a bit of gym work, stuff like that.
Philip has been in the rodeo club for a couple of years and has his sights set on becoming a professional bull rider.
Like, I grew up watching it sort of on TV, the PBR, but I never really took an interest to it until I come here and I thought it's an opportunity. PBR is ultimate goal, go to America, like explore over there, it's bigger money over there, see where it takes me, I guess. Well, you got to ride your bull for 8 seconds and it's your goal, pick up a check if you get a good enough score. You get like your rider score and then you get your bull score. So the higher your bull bucks, the more sort of aggression and sort of stuff it has, the higher it kicks, turns back, all that sort of stuff. You get scored on that and then you get your rider, so like your style, if you ride, like obviously ride time and like your moves you're making, sort of stuff like that, gets all scored on that. The neater you make it look, the better you get, the score you get.
Could you imagine not having it?
It's just sort of a part of me now. Couldn't really imagine stop doing it. It doesn't seem right.
Philip Sheehan, a Year 11 student and member of the Rodeo Club at St Brendan's College in Yeppoon. He was speaking with reporter Erin Semler. You're listening to Country Breakfast on RN. Still to come, we'll hit the road with a couple exploring remote Australia. They're doing it a bit tougher than most, pedalling their way from Cairns to Broome. Now, though, we'll join the truffle harvest with a farmer and her canine helpers.
We have traditionally known as the Perigord black truffle. It's a mysterious fungus that's completely unpredictable. From one day to the next, we're not quite sure what we're going to find out here. The season comes into production in early June and goes through to at least mid-August, sometimes late August. And what we find as we have more experience with it, more trees come into production for us, and the levels of production on individual trees as their root systems grow increases as well.
As winter sets in, the truffle season is getting underway at this farm in central Victoria. And for truffle farmer Sue Daly, that means a weekly cycle of hunting for these diamonds of gastronomy.
We take our dogs out on generally Fridays and we'll mark trees that the dogs are telling us there is truffle on. The truffles and the trees that they mark may not be necessarily ripe at that point, so then it's a process of going through to establish whether they're ready for harvest. That involves getting down on our hands and knees and having a sniff of the soil. If we can smell nice, ripe, beautiful, aromatic truffle, then we will harvest it.
For Sue, a nurse by training, this regime of searching out truffles is a bit of a change, but it's one she's enjoying. Hello, I'm Jessica Schremmer,
I'm here with Sue walking through the grove of 360 oak trees on her property near Dalesford with truffle hunting dogs Abby and Holly. Sue explains after the truffles are cleaned, they then go through a crating process.
Some truffles are very big. We've had truffles as large as almost a kilo, and the market for those is obviously quite small. No home buyer would use a kilo of truffles potentially in their lifetime, but for some of the restaurants, our larger truffles tend to go to restaurants that like to parade them through a restaurant under a dome, wafting that smell right through the restaurant as they go to grate it on a dish, which is a great way of showcasing this magnificent product.
Holly and Abby, they're your helpers. How long did it take you, or what process is involved to actually train them to find truffles?
We decided in 2010 that it was possible we would have our first truffles in 2011, and realised that if we had any chance of finding those, we needed help. Canine help. So I sourced a pair of sisters, Abby and Holly. They're Border Collie Lab Cross. All sorts of dogs can be trained in truffle scent detection. These girls have worked out to be particularly good at what they do for us. We started out sitting them on the deck in the height of winter, and we'd hold a truffle scent using truffle oil in one hand and have nothing in the other hand, and they had to tell us which of those hands had truffle scent in it. When they got that right, they got a click using clicker training, and followed up immediately by a reward. They just love a little piece of cabana. Once they got really good at that, we made it a little bit more difficult for them by putting that truffle scent out in the open lawn and asked them to identify it for us. When they approached that and got it right, they got a click and a reward. Positive reinforcement. We got to the point then where we wanted them to distinguish the smell of truffle aroma from the earthy smell of real earth, so we would start burying the truffle oil or the truffle scent in the dirt around the garden and have them wander around and find truffle by using their nose to discern where it was. Once again, when they got it right, they got a click and a reward, and we were pretty proud the day that Abby, at 11 months of age, came out and showed us where our very first ever truffle was.
And I guess you often get the question from consumers, like, why is truffle so expensive, right? What does it currently trade for, and what's the work that goes into growing one tiny piece of truffle?
That's a really good question. There is a myth that truffles are expensive. That's not really true at all when you think about it. We planted our trees in 2007 and then played a long game of patience before we harvested our first truffles in 2011. In that space of time, we'd probably invested, for our 360 tree plantation, well over $100,000 in the infrastructure, the irrigation, the soil management, and so on. So there's a huge investment before we patiently waited to see a truffle. Truffles you'll generally find on the market for around about $2.50 a gram, and interestingly, that price hasn't moved in the 10 years I've been associated with selling truffles. Importantly though, if you're thinking about using truffles in home cooking, you would buy a truffle that's in the order of 20 to 30 grams for a dinner party for six and have an amazing experience with it, and you'd pay no more than what you'd pay for a really nice bottle of champagne or a nice bottle of wine.
What's truffle mainly used for?
So truffle pairs really nicely with so many foods. Foods that have a fat content, so the egg yolks, magnificent. And in fact, if you put your truffle in with a jar of eggs, you'll find that the truffle aroma and flavour permeates the egg yolk. You leave that for 2 days and you'll have a fantastic poached egg or your scrambled egg dish, and you still haven't used any of your truffle. So it's an amazing way to experience the flavour and aroma of real truffle without actually using up any of your truffle. That leaves you with your truffle then to put into your pasta, your risotto, your mashed potatoes. It goes really nicely into butter, and with butter you can use it in all sorts of things. And I just love a dollop of truffle butter on a beautiful medium rare fillet steak.
Grey nomads making the pilgrimage north from the cooler climes of southern Australia are a familiar part of the landscape. Most are easily recognisable because they're travelling in caravans, four-wheel drives or motorhomes. But Victorian couple Brad and Liz Nilbert are an exception. They're doing it on a bicycle.
I'm 61 and I want a challenge. And last year we were actually visiting friends who live in Mossman, and she said something about riding a bike from Cairns to broom, and it just went ding, a little thing in my head, and I thought, wouldn't that be an amazing challenge?
We do a bit of bike riding at home, but nothing as adventurous as this.
G'day, I'm Charlie MacKillop, and I've crossed paths with Liz and Brad here at Pinnerendy Station, inland of Cairns, on the way to Mount Surprise in far north Queensland. It's a working cattle station, farm stay, and increasingly popular cafe, where tourists travelling along the Savannah Way stop in for a well-deserved break. The pair are a couple of hundred kilometres into their big adventure, and they have a few thousand more to go.
We're hoping not to stay on the bitumen, so we're looking at the alternative Savannah Way, go up through to Burketown and across to Borroloola and to Roper Bar. If the bodies hold up and if we can carry enough supplies.
You're just listing those names off the top of your head. They're names of isolated, remote locations that most of us fear to go in a fully equipped conventional vehicle. You're on two wheels. What kind of research have you had to do to embark on an adventure like this?
We've probably been researching for about 6 or 7 months. First thing was getting bikes we thought might hold up to the task. So it's a full circle. We're back on the old steel bikes. But, you know, we're taking a few precautions as well, like we got ourselves a spot tracker that kept our children back home happy, knowing that in a life-threatening situation we have got an out. But the rest of it, we've just got to tough it out and see how we go.
Along the way we've sent food parcels, because dehydrated stuff is what we need to carry, obviously, and places have been fantastic accepting that. That makes it a lot easier because we'll only have to carry, like we'll collect something from Borroloola to get us to Roper Bar, and then we'll go and stay at Nooka. And then from Nooka to Mataranka, we're back in civilization. The most challenging bit, I think, is once we leave Hell's Gate Roadhouse, we stop at Borroloola, but then on to Roper Bar. That is two quite long periods of time we really are going to have to be very resilient.
When you are on the back of a bicycle, what do you see that perhaps some of the other people that are parked up here at Pinnerendy might have missed in their dark-tinted, fully air-conditioned, fully equipped four-wheel drives and caravans?
We're both keen bird watchers, very keen bird watchers, and riding along today, we've seen a number of really beautiful birds. It's just lovely to take your time and breathe it in and smell it. Or when it's roadkill, that's not such a nice smell.
I suppose the thing is that you can pick and choose what you do. Like, we can do 50 k's a day, or we were actually going to go a bit further today. We didn't know this place was here, and then we saw a sign saying 1.5 k's is this place. So, you know, you've got the flexibility to do that. We can also, with those bikes, duck down a dirt road if we want to. We can explore some places that perhaps you might just normally zip past in the car.
These decisions that are made, are they by consensus?
Well, we were on our way to the 40-mile scrub National Park. We saw there was a picnicky area there, and we thought, well, that will do us tonight, hopefully. And then there's this lovely sign saying cafe. We just looked at each other and put our thumbs up, and that was it. Yes, we're going there. I think as long as it's a good coffee, we'll go anywhere.
Any room for a bottle of red wine or anything in this kit?
Unfortunately, no. Our water is actually, that's going to be a challenge, because Western Australia had a very, very poor wet season. So where we thought we'd be able to cross rivers and get water could be interesting. So that's going to be a real challenge. So we've actually got the capacity to carry about 25 litres. And I think we'll have to carry every bit of that at parts, yeah.
Tell us a bit about your pack. What have you brought with you, and what have you learned since you've set off about what you wish you'd brought with you?
Well, Liz was pretty diligent and got onto the life-saving type of thing. So we've got our water filters, so we can, you know, even if it's just a puddle, we've got something we can probably extract some water out of that along the way when we run out of fresh water. The thing we're finding out, we've got 4 pannier bags, and we think we know what's in each one until you pull up each night and you pull everything out of every one and you don't find what you're looking for.
Looking ahead to the adventure that you've still got before you and all of those kilometres in some of the most remote but remarkable parts of Australia, are you more excited or daunted by the challenge?
Absolutely excited. It's a real challenge. It's sort of like, I didn't get to live in the 1700s when everything was pioneering, so this is my little attempt at doing something a little bit out there and challenging and see how I cope.
It's a bit of a thrill and adrenaline rush when you're going along, and at the start of the day you think, oh gee, it's a long way to the next stop, but before you know it you've stopped and had a break and you're nearly there. And it's different to, like, when you're on a road bike, most of the time it's about the destination, whereas what we're doing, it's all about the journey.
Yeah, so it's just really slow and see how it goes. We've got no agenda, just carry on each day, see where we get to. If we're tired, have a day off and the bottom will like that very much.
Victorians Brad and Liz Nilbert, they're cycling from Cairns to Broome and spoke to our reporter Charlie McKillop just a couple of days into their epic adventure. Reporter Jessica Schremer took us truffle hunting before that. And I'm Clint Jasper bringing you Country Breakfast. Ahead on the show, a farming collective that's helping people, 22 of them in fact, skirt the enormous financial barriers to starting your own farm.
Margie said something to someone else when we were courting, which I always remembered.
She looks a little perplexed.
she said that, you know, we have to learn the skills to work together because they're not skills that we're born with. You know, that's a really big thing that this group of people here have invested in skill development. They haven't just hoped that it would happen.
Didn't even know how brilliant you were, did you? Prophetic.
Oh, well, you know, we share farm tools. It made sense to share people skill. Actually, if anyone's going to do any sort of group work or, you know, particularly things like this, you do need a people tool. You can't just assume that people will get along.
We'll find out how it all works very shortly.